Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, First Draft. ESPN experts Mel Kiper Jr., Todd McShay, and Field Yates keep tabs on the NFL draft throughout the year, but they're in the home stretch now and really finding their rhythm. This week, they discuss Todd McShay's all-satellite team with Tutu Atwell and Dwayne Eskridge and break down Mel Kiper Jr.'s two-round mock draft 4.0 with two more trades. Follow First Draft as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Also, don't miss Football Americas, the new soccer debate show where Hercules Gomez and Sebastian Salazar cover the U.S. and Mexican national teams throughout the season. Stream new episodes every Monday and Thursday, only on ESPN+. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It is that time of week where we have a guest joining us from ESPN, currently working on a book about Ricky Henderson. How are Brian? What's going on?
Good morning. Good morning. What's up?
Hey, man. So what do you think about Major League Baseball? After they moved the All-Star game out of Atlanta, which turned into its own thing, we got the situation going on right now with Dante Wright being killed by the police in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, and the Twins were the first people to say, hey, we're not going to play a game because of this. And I've been very interested, like, in the way our network has handled this, right? Like, there's been a whole lot of, you know, solemn tones and discussion about the event that happened, and then it got tricky for me, right? It got to a lot of discussion about how, you know, these teams cancel these games and it's good for the players because they just need a break and so forth and so on. But I was like, nah, I read what the Twins said. They shut that down because they ain't want this protest to come at their doorstep. Like, they called it safety concerns, which I guess it's been part because they got curfew and everything else. But I'm like, nah, nah, nah. They looked around and was like, nah, we're not doing this right now. No, sir.
I think that there's a couple of things about this that I find sort of fascinating. And I think one is the difference in language. If you go back to 2016, you go back to post-Ferguson, none of these leagues even mentioned the fact that a person was killed. They never said anything, no matter who it was. And you think about the number of times that you talked about police at the ballpark. And I used to watch these games in New York, and I was like, okay, you got all these cops here, and no one's going to mention Eric Garner by name. They're actually saying the names of the people who are affected. Having a moment of silence for Dante Wright. That's brand new, right? That's very, very different. I don't know if you call it progress, but you got to call it something. And it needs to be acknowledged in some way because it does say, like, for all the people out there who are like, oh, well, what's protest going to do? What's all this going to do? It does a lot. Because when you think about where we were, you go back to Freddie Gray, John Angelos of the Baltimore Orioles, up to this date, up till this happened, up to last year, to 2020, he was the only member of any sports team who actually mentioned the fact that Freddie Gray got killed and that the team belonged to everybody, you know? And what you have in sports is essentially that the team belongs to the cops. He was the only one.
Not just that he mentioned it. The working people of this country have been betrayed.
Exactly.
Peter Angelos was a labor lawyer.
That's right. This is my wheelhouse. And so when you start looking at what has taken place over the past year, there are tangible blocks where you can say the dialogue is different. The problem that I have with it is that the dialogue is different, but that the end result remains the same, which is we're going to a black funeral. There's more black pain. There's more black trauma. The optics of the ceremony have changed in some ways. Is it a more respectful tone? Absolutely. Is it a more acknowledging tone that Dante Wright didn't just happen to die, that somebody killed him and that somebody was the state? Are all these things more acknowledgeable now than they were in the past? Absolutely. But the one thing that remains the same is who's getting shot and by whom. And that is the piece of this where I just feel like if you're not the target, I don't want to hear from you, right? I don't really want to hear about these intellectual debates about policing. I'm not interested in it. I'm really tired of the gaslighting of all of it because at the end of the day, you're not the target. We're the target. And I appreciate the fact that the Twins did what they did, because it was, like, you're right, it was absolutely a very parsed statement. It was safety concerns, which was to say, okay, we don't need this, don't come over here. But it was also different in the messaging as well, which was to acknowledge that the state is killing its citizens and that everybody else has to deal with the fallout, and the twins are part of it.
Yeah, like, I wonder how this goes if Dante Wright was not shot in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Right. And I ask that because one thing we got to remember is after George Floyd, we're coming up on 1 year of that, right?
That's right. May 29th.
After George Floyd, they did disband the police, right? Like, the city council passed that, and that's the plan. Like, they seem to be in a different space in that area on all of these things, which I think is kind of an important variable when we bring this up. Like, if this had happened in Los Angeles, is it playing out the same way? And that's not a judgment on anybody involved. Like, I just wonder how that piece of context has affected the fact that this went down. But you're absolutely right. And I talked about this yesterday on television briefly, that since George Floyd, the language around it is different. And you're right. The idea that there was a moment of silence for him. There was a time not that long ago where if they had a moment of silence, then the cops were going to say, well, fine, we will not moonlight at your games anymore.
Absolutely. I'm glad you said that, because we know what was going to happen next, right? Let's also not forget that it was 7 years ago. The St. Louis Rams came out with the hands up, don't shoot. And immediately the St. Louis Police Union went to Roger Goodell to get the players suspended. So they were active, and then they didn't want to go work Beyonce's concert. Remember, they didn't want to give her protection. And then they did the same thing with the Cleveland Browns when they came out and took a knee before the game. And so there was like this punitive reaction. There was this aggressive reaction that they tried to employ as an intimidation method. And now, absolutely, when the team is having a moment of silence for you, they are legitimizing at some level your claim. They're realizing that harm has been done to you by the people that we spend a lot of time glamorizing and glorifying. And one other piece to that, that we've also embedded into our business model. You don't see cops singing the national anthem that much anymore.
That's real. That's real. I do hope this, though. I do hope they keep the military singing the national anthem. And I only say that because I find nothing more enjoyable than when they have a chubby dude in a sailor suit get up there and start singing. That just makes me smile every single time, boy. I think it's in Philadelphia, one of the places. They got the chubby brother who gets out there and he's in the Navy and he's in his sailor suit and he be singing the hell out the national anthem, man. I don't know why. It just makes me so happy every time I see that chubby dude sing the national anthem in his sailor suit.
Hey, you know what? To each his own, man. There's certain things we got to have in our rituals, right?
Yeah, that's the only one. That one right there, I'm like, nah, nah, nah. This brings me joy.
Where is Private Doughboy? I want to hear you.
But I think that so much interesting is happening with, like, just surrounding this one. And they fired the police officer already. Like, if any place found Jesus on these matters, it seems to be Minneapolis, St. Paul. I don't know how and why it wound up happening in that case. Or maybe part of it for them too is, don't forget, you remember when that Somali dude shot that white woman who walked up on him? He was done. But I feel like once that happened, that becomes the ultimate what about.
Well, it does.
And guides how you are now going to have to behave after the fact. Or maybe that's a possibility, because I think that one gets forgotten, because that happened. And then everybody was like, okay, well, now we got to be fair about what we say about the police. This dude's got to go down. And what was wild to me about that one was, on the list of things that cops use to get away with shooting people, his was as strong an excuse as anybody's had. She walked up on me in my car, and they still sent him up.
That's right. And I think it's important to remember two other things. One, let's not forget about Minneapolis as a place, right? A little different than Milwaukee. Milwaukee's racism and Milwaukee's history is far worse in a lot of ways. But Minneapolis is one of those places where the people of Minneapolis really do believe that they are good people. Minneapolis is one of those do-gooder cities where the people want to believe that this is a very good place for you to live. This is a good place for all of us to live. This is a place where we have the right values and all of those things, right? It's not like Chicago or Philly or Boston, where as much as there's a do-gooder element there, there's also this hard hat element there too, which is like, no, we're not budging and we're not giving into these black people, right? So you've got that sort of ethnic fight in some of the other cities that you don't necessarily have as much in Minneapolis. Minneapolis has a very high opinion of itself in terms of being a good place to live. And when these things are happening in your town, whether it's last year, let's not forget, Philando Castile wasn't in Minneapolis per se, but it was close enough, right? And so now what does that do to your worldview? Maybe we're not what we should be, and they're open to trying some different stuff. And sometimes these experimental, if you want to call it that, or some of these reforms take place in places like that, because some of these people have to look in the mirror and say, we're not walking the walk.
Also of note, as you mentioned, Philando Castile, because I'd forgotten that that was in that area. They keep winding up on the Summer Jam screen in Minneapolis, which gets back to your point, which is it's good that you have all these people who are doing the right thing or saying the right things, but it doesn't change the fact that, all right, that's three. That's three that we're talking about. And, you know, three that we have some like reasonable amount of video on, because that's the thing that really makes these things, you know, power through.
That's right. And also, let's not forget, you had a presidential candidate, Amy Klobuchar, whose presidential campaign really took a nosedive when she was defending the cops and didn't have much of an answer.
Yeah. She thought she was going to be vice president. Nah, dog. Sorry. We need all the black people to vote. That was it. That was it. It was just like, nah. Nice try. Yeah, I know that was the play then. Like, you were doing the job that you had at the time. And the job that you had at the time was this. Totally understand. Sorry, new job. Old job messed up, new job.
That's right. And also, let's not forget that you also have the Joe Biden, who's been talking about giving more money to police. And also, let's not forget, you had Barack Obama last year telling the players to not walk out and go back to work. So this entire reflex of protecting police regardless is up against it right now. And even the people that you look at and you say, okay, here's the playbook that has always worked to sort of straddle the line, that's not really working per se anymore either. And we're going to find out. You and I talked about this last year. We're going to find out the limits of what the players can do. Are you going to walk out every time this happens? What is going to be the norm? Because we're still talking about labor here too. And so it's going to be real interesting to find out how much stamina these players have, because we know that because of their money, that they honestly believe they can make some concierge phone call to some state senator or whatever and think that a couple of ride-alongs are going to solve stuff. And now they're finding out that that's not what's happening. They're finding out that, guess what? It all goes back to the same. So are the players going to hang in there, or are they going to say, look, we went out there, we did our best, and nothing changes. We're going to go back to playing ball.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Let's take this beyond the players, though. Did you see what Greg Popovich said on his Zoom?
Oh, yeah.
This, to me, I feel like we haven't seen this come up in enough places. And the article where I want to get this from my man Mike Finger, the San Antonio Express News, they want me to subscribe. But he got on his Zoom and said, I want to know what owners are funding these lies.
Here we go.
That is the hardest statement that anybody has made up until this point. And by the way, to me, the fact that that doesn't lead every sports television show tells you a lot about just kind of how contrived we are as an industry in the way that we handle this, because that is the most controversial thing. Like, for, you know, like, oh, somebody said something controversial. That is as controversial as anything that anybody has said. So I do think that right now we got this thing where we like putting players on screen and, you know, say a little something, tell you about their pain and everything else. Because right now everything's focused on, like, I'm so tired. And I'll be honest, I'm not tired. I recommend to people you stop watching these goddamn videos and stop, like, the details don't matter nearly as much as people. Like, I don't need to be prepared for a barbershop argument about this so I can go frame by frame and tell you what I saw in the video. There's a macro level problem and I don't need to see the little parts because all it does is make me miserable, right? And so I do think that we go a little too hard with this with a lot of players, where we put them up there just to talk about how they're sick and tired of it and they're not going to take it, because that's a very basic thing that I guess that people can wrap their minds around.
Well, you can relate to that and feel human and change nothing.
Exactly. But Popovich, and keeping in mind, when he's like, I want to know what owners fund these lies, he knows one owner who does, and it's the one that signs his checks. Let me be clear that he was not clear, but go look at where Peter Holt, the owner of the Spurs, gives his money, and you will see that Popovich dropped a bomb in the house when he did that.
Well, exactly. And my big fear for someone like Pop, and by the way, let the record show that when Greg Popovich says things like this, this is the reason why I'm no longer upset with Pop when he just says one sentence answers in the middle of a second quarter interview.
Right.
I'm good with that now. I'm like, okay, here's my fear about Pop. It's the same fear that I have with him, Stan Van Gundy, and Steve Kerr, that people just begin to dismiss them as cranks. He's actually one of the most important people in sports right now. He's unraveling all of what we're talking about. And what he's really doing is he's taking the pressure off of the players and he's saying, okay, he's Lester in The Wire. Follow the money.
Yes.
You know, if you follow drugs, you'll find drugs. But if you follow the money, you don't know where you're going to end up, right? I mean, this is what Pop is saying. The people that he's really talking to, he's talking to us. He's talking to journalism. He's saying, this is your job. This is your responsibility to unravel this. There's all kinds of public open documents about where the money goes. We saw with the NFL about the owners that were given to Trump's campaign. It's all there in many, many ways. And what he's really saying is, instead of laying all of this on the players, the actual mechanism of police brutality, the actual mechanisms of white supremacy are right in front of your faces. Do you have what it takes to call them out?
And see, those three guys, it's an interesting juxtaposition, I think, with those three. Now, I want to be clear. The only one of them that I know even a little bit personally is Stan.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Stan.
I love Stan the way you love the dude singing the national anthem.
In sailor suit.
My pleasure of watching the NBA is at least once a season to have the camera go in to Stan in the huddle and listen to Stan pleading, guys, guys, work together, guys. And I'm like, here's a man who knows he doesn't have any power. He wants them to help him.
Yes.
Work with me, please. If you do this, I promise you good things will happen.
Yeah, Stan realizes what the dynamic is in this. Like Mike Brown once said that players allow you to coach them.
That's
right. And Stan definitely gets that. Stan's real cool with Dan. And so, you know, I've met him through that. And I just always describe Stan is a good man. Like, I say that with no equivocation, and I do not say that lightly. Like, I've always felt like Stan is a good man, and Stan believes this, and Stan was on the ground in this, in Florida, like, helping to get the bill passed to give felons back the right to vote, and, like, shouting out the fact that the Players Coalition was also involved with this. Like, Stan is not just some dude on Twitter who's just cranking all this stuff out. Stan's been there on the ground. Steve Kerr, I do not know as well, but I take a little less seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be honest, I take him a little less seriously because of that day where he stood up and said, give your money to the Lincoln Project. That's where I was just like, oh, you don't even know what you're talking about here. Like, you got a good heart.
In the right place, don't quite know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. You see things going on in the world and you want to do something to change them. And the people that you think can change these things are not the good guys, right? Like that's where I was just like, hey, I don't know about you. Pop becomes interesting to me because the thing that was hard for me to get over with Pop was his thing about how the Europeans work harder and are less spoiled. And that's why he likes to have them on the team with the Spurs. And I'm like, you need to go ask some of these dudes on your team where they came from before you come out here and talk about, you know, how they got all these things handed to them. And maybe he meant it in a very particular way, but that never set right with me.
And Steve Kerr is part of that chain. And then it goes back to the Chicago thing as well. It goes back to the Bulls. It also goes back to Nelly out in you know, in Oakland, you know, with the European influence. And to me, I've always been skeptical, if we're just going to throw it out here, let's throw it out here. I mean, I always believed that at some level, the influence of the European players was designed to reduce the number of black players in the game. And actually what it ended up doing was reduce the number of white American players. But I always felt because you can hear it, that they're more coachable. They're just as athletic, but they're coachable. And you can hear all the code words in there. You could hear it with Tony Kukoc. You heard it with Šarūnas Marčiulionis back in the day. You could hear it with all these different, you know, you could hear it with Ginobili. And it was like, although he's not European, but you know.
No. He European. He just from Argentina.
He just from Argentina. Oh, no, exactly. Right. But if we're just looking at it from geography, yeah. He played down there. But you're right. That's why I'm trying to remind people. They may speak Spanish, but he's still white, right? Don't forget yes. That part, right? Don't forget that part. But yeah, I mean, and so that piece of it has always made me a little uncomfortable. The end result, however, with 30 years of sample size, has been pretty much the elimination of the white American basketball player as your player, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when I was growing up, you could name a dozen white American NBA All-Stars. Today, who is the best white American-born basketball player? Gordon Hayward?
Yeah, without giving it a lot of thought.
I mean, that's a far cry from Larry Bird. It's a far cry from Tom Chambers. It's a far cry from guys back then, you know, from Kevin McHale. It's a far cry from guys who could actually really, really play.
Hell, Danny Ainge.
And Danny Ainge.
Like, quietly, mm-hmm. Danny Ainge. Incredible athlete, right? It's funny that you put Ceruta's Barcelonas on that list because let me tell you something. I don't know how you would do it where you could see Ceruta's Barcelonas play but not know that he was white or not know that he was European. Ceruta's Barcelonas looked like every other dude in the NBA. He had, like for lack of a better term, that game was black, dog. There's no way around. You go look up, for those of you who don't know who Ceruta's Barcelonas is, he is actually the first player to come from the Soviet Union to play in the United States. He was like a 6'3 guard who played for the Warriors. And like he fit in Oakland. It made like his game fit in those Eastern European cats, like the Croatians, like my man Hazonia. I'm like, yo, man, you from the south side of Croatia, apparently, you know?
Drazen Petrovic, you know, the guys, yeah. And they came in.
West side!
Right? And so, I mean, I remember watching them going, okay. And it wasn't the fact that they were arriving. I didn't really care about that. What got me was the way that they were positioned. It was almost specifically anti-black, that these guys are humble, that they're coachable. I'm like, okay, well, who are you talking about? Who's not coachable? Who's not humble? We know exactly what you're doing here. And so I always try to like get over myself when I see that, because it's like, okay, you can't be like dogging the player because you don't like how it sounds. It's, the player's not the one talking about himself like this. They're all sort of part of it, right?
Yeah. I got to deal with that with Luka. Because I got no problem actually with Luka. I just be out here like, are y'all actually watching what's going on here? It's not that he's not good. But when everybody came this year and was like, Luka Doncic is going to be the MVP. I'm like, see, that's that shit right there. And nobody mad that they're at the sixth seed. The Mavericks are interesting, right?
You know who I'm thinking about right now? When I see all these guys who get all this shine, but at the end of the day, you still can't even get in the top four in your conference, is Carmelo. Carmelo got dogged for everything he wasn't for his entire career.
Yep.
If you're the MVP of the league, Luka, in a league like basketball, you better be a 1-2. You better be a 1-seed. You can't be no 6-seed in basketball. If you're really all about it, this is the one sport where you dominate everything if you're that good.
But these Mavericks, I can't think of the last time a team had this many white dudes. Like, I was joking about it. J.J. Redick went for the team with all the Duke guys and then wound up on a team that looked like Duke. Like Duke used to look. Like there was a different point. Like 10 years ago, Duke.
And who used to coach the Warriors? Nelly.
The thing happened with Nelly where he went to the Knicks and it was an outright disaster. And them dudes were not here for him whatsoever. And he decided that will never
happen again.
And I'm not making this up. He was loud about it. Like, I think he got to Dallas at first as the general manager. And he made it clear, I am going to be old school. And he went through the list of people that were old school. Now Nelly in Hawaii just smoking weed all the time.
Exactly, right?
But he was adamant, like, this is what I'm going to be. Now look, he got Dirk Nowitzki out of his European fascination. And also, to be fair to Nelly, Nelly had a forward-thinking vision of the NBA that the Europeans were on beforehand. The United States was not producing players with the skill set of Dirk Nowitzki, who legitimately has a claim that for a 3 or 4 year stretch, he was the best player in the NBA, right?
That's right.
But I'm looking at this Mavericks team. It used to be that you went and got like the best of the best Europeans. Now it's like Doncic, Porzingis, and dudes. I don't know how you say dude in European, but you know what I'm saying? It's dudes. And it's like, I'm not saying anybody's doing anything wrong with this. But it is rare, and in the NBA in particular, that you wind up with a team that is like as white as that team is, and nobody talks about it in either direction. You know why? Because they're not good enough for us to talk about it. Like, they mess around and get a 2-seed, and then all of a sudden you're going to hear all the code come out. They mess around and get an 11-seed, and people are going to start talking about how they need more athleticism. Right now, they're just hiding in plain sight at 6.
Where's Richard Spencer out there talking about how, you know, this is his favorite team, like he did the Patriots?
Yes.
When you got Tom Brady, Edelman, and Amendola out there, and you're beating the 70% black league, then all them white boys, they're like claiming you. And I'm actually not even trying to be funny about this. It's like when I was coming up, we always knew the three whitest teams in the NBA. It was by design. It wasn't an accident, right? It was the Boston Celtics, who, by the way, In 1986, when they won the championship, 10 of the 14 players were white. The Phoenix Suns and the Utah Jazz, those were traditionally the three most white teams. You know, they always had the most, the highest number of white players. So when you were constructing this, I would always say to have 10 guys out of 14 be white in a league that's 80% black is hard to do by accident.
Yes.
As raw numbers go, that's some bad math if that's your calculation.
Yeah, although I'll give this to the Celtics about that. This is the thing about Red. That was a fluctuation with Red, right? Like in the 60s, they were all black. And then he realized that the locals were not going to pay to watch that team. But when Red went and got white dudes, yeah, there might be some like Victory Cigar type dudes. Red was like, go get me the coldest white boy on earth. He that's won't right. play. John, that's why we have John Havlicek. We
have Dave Bird.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Cowens, a little bit overrated, right? Like he fit the aesthetic of what people wanted. Dave Cowens winning an MVP over Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and I think it was 1974, when you go back and look at it, is kind of one of those, like we gave it to Karl Malone over Michael Jordan type of situations. We just got tired of it, right? But Cowens could ball, right? So Kevin McHale, Danny Ainge, even if it was the carcass of Bill Walton, by and large. Bill Walton, Pete Maravich.
Pete Maravich. And also, let's not forget, even the guys that they got in the 80s who were supplementary players were still former All-Stars. Scott Wedman, Jim Paxson, those guys were good players.
Yeah.
Right? They could play.
Yeah, Rick Carlisle is like the worst of them.
Greg Kite was the worst of them.
Oh, yeah. There was like Greg Kite. There was Brad Lowhouse.
Oh my God. And Joe Klein. That's when it started to go down. But let the record show also that the Phoenix Suns, who are the second team that always had a whole bunch of white players, traded Dennis Johnson for Rick Roby straight up. Thank you for playing.
Yes. Yes. The Rick Roby, whom the Celtics were getting out of town. Why?
Because he was turning Larry Bird into a drunk. Because Bird was never going to reach his potential with a drinking buddy. And nobody talks about that. And it's amazing to me how many times when you have black players, they always talk about, we got to get this guy out of here because he's a bad influence, man. This dude's a bad influence on Doc Gooden. This dude's a bad influence on this guy, on all these great players. We got to nurture our players and keep the bad Negroes away from this guy because he's got star power. Larry Bird does not, it's not a coincidence that Larry Bird won 3 straight MVPs when you got Rick Roby the hell out of town.
Right. You're right, though. I can tell you the day that I believe that you could look in the history of the Boston Celtics and be like, yep, nah, this is becoming a problem. And it's when they drafted Michael Smith out of BYU with like the number 11 pick in the draft. Fred Roberts, that's who I was thinking about. It reminds me, actually, this is right when Duke realized they had to start doing things differently because it looked like all they were doing basically was going and getting a white dude, whatever white dude was left. And I think it was recruiting class that was Miles Plumlee. And then they went and got this guy named Oleg Chiz, who ultimately transferred to Nevada. But he had hops, but he had no game. Like he had all the hops, but he was the last white dude left. It seemed, right, that they were just scraping and getting the last white dude. And then it reached a point where they looked up and they only had 3 black dudes on the team. And by the way, won the national championship. I mean, it was a weird year, but they won it. But then it was just like, yo, man, we can't keep living like this. And then it went back to, wait, we're Duke. We can get the coldest white dudes in the world.
That's right. And when that happens, you know, you also realize, too, that there's a calculation here. And JoJo White and Cedric Maxwell and those guys used to say it. And then they got ostracized for saying it. Well, Max did. He was like, look, also, and it's all changed now because the numbers are just way different than they used to be, right? Every team at some level kind of looks the same. When the Celtics were good, if you go back and look at them in the mid-70s, in the late 70s when they were garbage, good Celtic teams always had a 50-50 mix. Always. If you go up until 86, even all the way up to the early 90 teams where they weren't championship level, but they were Eastern Conference final material, right? There was not a great Celtic team that was all black. Starting 5, best players, sure. But to play in Boston, you had to have your Greg Kites, man. You had to have your Jerry Seastings. You had Danny Ainge and Jerry Seaston. I remember watching the Celtics against Houston. I was watching that final because, and by the way, I know you're from Houston. However, it must be said, this may be an area where we break.
Is where you go trash Ralph Sampson again.
Goes.
I mean, I'm not a Rockets fan, but we appreciate a Ralph Sampson. My daddy loves talking about Ralph Sampson holding all the Celtics at bay with a jab. Dennis Johnson coming in and going back.
You kicked Jerry Seaston. You kicked him. You're 7'4", you kicked Jerry Seaston, and then didn't show up in Boston. I got to tell you that the little tiny still, like, okay, there's the Celtics fan in me, and then there's the black in me, so I'm like, I'm torn. Ralph has got to show up Sunday and ball out. But on the other hand, I really hope you get your ass kicked. And they did.
They got you.
Right? I mean, they got demolished in that game. And Larry wasn't messing around. And disclaimer for people that don't know the Black Bostonian, right? We rode hard for every brother who wore that green because we knew what they were up against, right? People be like, oh, man, you were a Celtics fan? You were Bird McKell? No, I was a Gerald Henderson, Tiny Archibald, Robert Parrish dude, right? Dennis Johnson, because you had to, like, support them. Anyway, the fact that Robert Parrish went up against Olajuwon and Ralph Sampson and came away with a championship, you got to give Chief his props for that.
Yeah, yeah. Like I say, talking to you about the Celtics as a Black person from Boston is always so interesting because, like, I guess there's a whole generation of people now who just don't understand this.
Brothers in Boston were like, they were Sixers fans and Lakers fans. And if you rode with the Celtics, they looked at you like, I ain't sure about you.
It's kind of how there's all those Cowboys fans in D.C. because of the history of the franchise. Like, it's a lot. But again, the Celtics were forerunners of integration.
And that's why we were Celtics fans. My mother used to tell me, I never went to Boston Garden to see a Celtics game because they were always sold out. We couldn't get in. But my mother was like, you've been to a Celtics game. I'm like, no, I haven't. Not the Garden. She's like, I took you in utero. She's like, you saw Bill. You didn't see Bill Russell play. I saw Bill Russell play. So my and of course, remember that Satch Sanders and, you know, Russell owned the joint. He owned Slade's right there in Roxbury.
Hold on. He owned what?
Slade's, the bar, the restaurant.
Slade's. I thought you said he owned something else. And I was like, yo.
Hey, did you know Bill Russell owned Slade's? What did you say?
I was like, you're going to need to clarify that for everybody listening.
S-L-A-D, as in David E, apostrophe S, Slade's. And so the Boston Black community was tight with the Celtics because they were right in Roxbury. So for that time period, people have to remember, because it's Boston. There's Black Boston and there's White Boston, right? So it's not the same city during those years. So for everybody out there who was a Collins Havlicek guy, we were Charlie Scott, JoJo White people, right? Now, obviously, you rooted for the whole team, but it wasn't like you weren't aware of where you came from.
Yeah.
And I do get defensive. I will tell you, I do get defensive when it comes to Larry Bird. And I will tell you why. Because every single white dude who can shoot a three is like the next Larry Bird. No, you're not.
No.
Because you know why? Because my favorite thing about Larry Bird wasn't just how tough he was. Watch Larry Bird on the defensive board. He wasn't playing, right? I mean, that's like real basketball. I just love the way that he played the game on a different. And the only guy, like one of my favorite things was when the Celtics finally got Kevin Garnett, I was like, oh, somebody's controlling the defensive board again. I'm like, this is Boston basketball.
Also, Larry Bird is, I don't think that this is an exaggeration. Larry Bird, through time and because race, is the most underrated defensive player in the history of the NBA. Larry Bird is a two-time second-team all-defense guy. People were not just lighting Larry Bird up like people assume. Larry Bird was so big at the time with what the spacing was in the NBA. Granted, you could isolate, but no. Larry Bird, I think, you know, gets you some, you know, passing lane type stuff and everything else.
Do you think Magic Johnson, over the course of his career, was a good defensive player?
He wasn't a bad one, but he wasn't a good one.
Exactly. Like Bird, they used to call him back in the day, they used to call him a team defender, right? So you would get Dominique to isolate him and try to light him up. But for the most part, when it was go time, Bird wasn't the guy you were looking for. He wasn't the guy you were trying to beat, right? When you had to go ISO on somebody, you usually went after Mikhail first, especially Worthy. Worthy loved that matchup, right? Now, he didn't want to deal with him on the offensive end, but defensively, you didn't, right, try to just line up Larry Bird and think he was the mark. He was not the mark on that team.
No, it took a little while, though, I think, for a lot of Black folks to be like, okay, no, you're right.
He's
like,
really good.
He was really good. Like, but this is my thing with Bird, and this is not his fault, obviously, but his rival and direct competitor was a dude 3 years younger than him, but we thought that they were basically of the same age. Like, when you look at it, the age that Bird was when he became the best player in the NBA is about the age Magic was when he became the best player in the NBA, because they were not on the same schedule. Bird got to college 3 years before Magic did.
That's right. And I'll tell you another thing about Bird that was always difficult for me, because it's always Boston, right? I wanted to enjoy Larry Bird, and eventually in my own time, in my own private space, I did, because you realize you had to give it up to him because he was a great, great player. But being in Boston, people always used Larry Bird as an example of white supremacy. And I'm like, damn, can we just enjoy him?
They right? always go too far.
Always got to go right there. And it was like, well, I remember one time I was in high school and a dude said to me, a white dude on my basketball team, and he was going to talking about Bird Bird. And I was like, and it's just some crazy ass racist stuff. And I was like, could you explain something to me? I was like, how can you watch the NBA? It's an 80% black league and feel this way. How is the NBA your even favorite sport? Why don't you watch hockey or NASCAR or something, right? And he said to me, well, basketball may be 80% black league, but the best player is white. And that was the framework in which you always had to deal with Larry Bird. So you couldn't even enjoy Bird as much as you wanted to because you knew that this is how they viewed him.
You was talking to Pino, isn't that his name?
Exactly, right? And do the right thing.
Pino, who's your favorite actor? Eddie Murphy. Right.
Who's your favorite singer? Prince, but they're not black, black. I mean, they're black, but they're not black. Did you hear yourself right now, Pino? Right? I mean, but seriously, I mean, that's sort of what it was. And so, like, we were all caught up. And you got to remember this, you still just a few years removed from busing and everything else in Boston, always had some racial stuff going on. So it made it really, really, really difficult to sort of just do the enjoy the Celtics as a great team. I also have one other thing that I have to admit as a Celtics fan, as a kid growing up. And that is, as an adult, it's hard to say, but it just has to be said. You know, I guess it's all part of healing and growth. Is that now in retrospect, I will admit that the Celtics were the team that started all that thug ball. Is Bill Laimbeer, is it really, I'm going to have to go text Joe Dumars about this, but is it really the Pistons' fault after all? It's really the Celtics' fault.
Kevin McHale clothesline
Kurt Rambis in game four.
White on white crime. America had no idea what to do in that moment. The whitest man in the NBA was just clotheslined by Kevin Munster right here. This is quite the circuitous podcast if you start getting around. We got to the Boston Celtics, which I am fascinated by those things. That, like, these are the things about race that I feel like are so under-discussed in our business because everybody's so petrified. But yes, the Mavericks clearly have a bunch of white dudes in a way that seems to be a few standard deviations away from the median and makes you ask questions about what exactly is going on in that. Okay, but those 80s teams, like, it's always interesting for me to talk to the white dudes who rooted for the Lakers because they assumed that the Celtics had to be sorry because of this weird self-hatred thing that white people have about themselves in basketball. Talk about the elimination of the white American basketball player. Like, outside of the Midwest, the white player has eliminated himself. Like, they still be out there doing it up there because it's too cold to be out there playing that other stuff. But down south, hey, maybe you get a few coming out of California, but... like, you're just not going to tell me that there ain't no white dudes out here that can hoop.
Did I ever tell you a bunch of years ago, I asked Danny Ainge about that? I think it was 15 years ago. So I asked Danny Ainge about that. He gave me one of the most fascinating, underrated answers. And I got to say, there's some truth to it. And Danny told me that, one, he said, America's got too much money. He says, that's one thing. He says, it's just other things to do, right? He just didn't feel like there was a lot of guys wanted to grind that way. And then he talked about race. And he said that a lot of today's white kids don't want to be minorities. He says, Kevin, Larry, me, part of us wanted to prove that we could play in the black game. We wanted to show we belong no matter where we were. We knew that we were underdogs and we knew. I mean, every white dude who's ever played basketball with a bunch of brothers, what's the word? Who got the white boy? That dude don't even have a name. Guard the white boy. He's the only one, right? Right? So Danny's point was, because a lot of these white kids don't want to be minorities and they don't want to deal with all the things that you have to deal with by being an outsider, because they just play other sports. They'll just go do something else. And I thought that was fascinating, especially when you look at the numbers, because maybe it just gets too hard and you think, oh, they actually get it. Nobody wants to be a minority, right? Nobody wants to be in that space. And he was talking about just the growth of other sports. He's like, people want to play lacrosse. They'll play it. They'll do other things to compete and not have to feel they don't want to put up with the hazing.
But it ain't even real hazing, right? We can't get away with nothing. The moral of the story there, and we're coming close to wrap, so I think this may be the best way to sum it up. This is what the wild moral of the story is, you just point out. Because it ain't like they not grinding playing these other games they play.
That's right.
Like, they not grinding playing lacrosse. They'd rather pay to be in a space with a bunch of white dudes than play the freest sport there is to play in America, which is basketball. All you have to do is show up somewhere where somebody is playing basketball. Like, we've somehow made soccer expensive in this country, which is
supposedly the sport of kings, the low overhead sport, the no overhead sport.
But all you have to do is show up and somebody will get you a basketball game. Like Rick Barry's kids would talk about, like, in the burbs, they couldn't find a game. They said they have to drive to Oakland, and then they find somebody with a trash can holding the door open, and then they could go in there and get a game. And actually, this is the funniest thing. I think this is about wrap off. People who are too young to know this, there's this dude named Rick Barry. Rick Barry honestly might be the biggest jerk ever to play NBA basketball. And the reason that I say that is he's the only white dude ever to not be overrated. Like, as cold as he was in a basketball player, everybody seems to hate his guts, right? Including people who know him very well. Anyway, Rick had these four boys. Yeah, four. They got this fifth one that came late, but he had four boys. One of them was named Drew, who played at Georgia Tech. I think he was the youngest one. Brent played at Oregon State, won a dunk contest. You've seen him. John played at Georgia Tech also, had a great NBA career. But the first one was Scooter. Scooter Barry was on the 88 Kansas team with Danny Manning that won the championship. And Scooter Barry had a completely different game than the other three Barrys, right? Like, my brother's friend used to say, Rick had Scooter in the driveway shooting underhand free throws, and he told the other boys to go down the street and play with whoever they were. But those three, and Rick, it's not like Rick Barry had some, like, stereotypically white game either. Like, Rick Barry was out there giving it to people, but it was always so wild. I guess Scooter just wasn't good enough to have the confidence, or Scooter did not go play with the rest of the kids, because where those three boys went to play clearly looked different than whatever Scooter Barry did to develop his game.
That's right. I will tell you one last thing as a reason why people hate Rick Barry was that day on the national broadcast on CBS. You remember this, right? On the national broadcast where they showed a picture of Bill Russell in the Navy and they were all doing the broadcast. I think it was Barry and it was Barry, Bill Russell. And I don't remember who was in the booth. Might have been Tom Brookshire or someone doing the NBA. And they show Bill Russell in the Navy clearly had a couple of drinks or whatever. And Rick Barry says on national television, Bill, give us that watermelon smile. Yes, he did.
And by the way, that's why some people hate him. White people hate him too. That ain't enough to do it for white folks. Like, he just all the way across the board. And I feel bad. Like, one time I talked to Rick Barry. We did an interview on Highly Questionable with him. And Dan asked him, so what player reminds you the most of yourself? And he was like, I think I'd probably say LeBron. But here's the thing. That's not an invalid thing to say. He was a point forward at a time where that was kind of a revolutionary concept.
Yes,
and could give you 35 a game.
In that regard, yes.
His game was, in fact, similar to LeBron's.
I mean, Scottie Pippen was a point forward, too, but you wouldn't call him LeBron.
Yeah, because he couldn't score like that.
He couldn't score.
The problem was that Rick Barry's the one that said it. Right? And I'm just sitting there like, really, LeBron? Except then I thought about it. I was like, yeah, this kind of makes sense, but... it was Rick Barry. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is your tour that started with black people and the police and ended with white people playing basketball. That is Howard Bryant. Check him out on ESPN, ESPN.com. Got a book on Ricky Henderson that will be coming out. I can't wait to read it. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for checking us out here on The Right Time. We do this thing three times a week. Gabe Bassett and Tony Colletti, you handled everything behind the scenes. Thank you, guys. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.